Thanks, Adrian, and thanks very much to Infrastructure Partnerships for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm very conscious of the infrastructure expertise in the room. There wouldn't be anything I could add to what you know about project design, selection, funding. What I would like to do today is place infrastructure in a broader context. Specifically, I plan to talk about the role of infrastructure from the perspective of someone involved in macroeconomic policy, the policy challenges and opportunities, the work of the G20, and the role of infrastructure as not just an engine of growth, but more importantly, an enabler of growth. Before getting into that, it's useful to define what we're talking about. When macroeconomists think about infrastructure, we think about the capital goods that provide public services. They are shared facilities that help economies function well. And specifically, they include the structures, the things produced by the construction industry that, unlike buildings, don't have roofs. But there are many other shared facilities that promote a well-functioning economy and society. One example of those other important pieces of infrastructure is the new payments platform that was launched recently. There are also important social infrastructures such as our legal system or our frameworks for safeguarding children. But for the purposes of my talk, I will focus on the things that are tangible. Within this class of tangible physical infrastructure, we can think of various kinds of physical assets. There's transport infrastructure, utilities providing electricity, gas and water, and communications infrastructure. Within each of these groups, there are the hubs or centres, such as airports and railway stations for transport, power stations and reservoirs providing utilities, or telephone exchanges and satellites facilitating communication. Also within each group are the paths or distribution networks, the road and rail networks, power lines and telecommunications networks. As you all well know, infrastructure of this kind can be provided by either the private or public sectors. The public sector might be involved for a number of reasons. One is that it is generally accepted that there are social benefits to providing these kind of assets that are not fully captured by a profit-making provider. Without some provision by the state, such infrastructure will be underprovided. Another is the network nature of these facilities. Where there is a network, there is an element of monopoly power, and thus often a role for state regulation, if not actually state ownership. At the very least, somebody needs to set the rules of the game, whether that is the side of the road that we drive on or the protocols used in telecommunications. Despite the role of the state in the provision and management of these types of infrastructure, they are not public goods in the textbook sense. Textbook public goods are non-rival and non-excludable. Their benefits aren't diminished by an extra person enjoying them, and in any case, you can't prevent people from having those benefits. Clean air and a defence force fall into this category. By contrast, physical infrastructure can clearly suffer from congestion. It is also conceptually possible to exclude free riders from the use of the infrastructure, though this is more easily achieved in some cases than others. It is from these characteristics, congestion, excludability, and the underlying monopoly network, that most of the policy challenges around infrastructure arise. Much like any business decision faced by private firms, decisions about infrastructure involve a lot of uncertainty. Businesses grapple with these questions every day. Should we build it? Is the market big enough? Where should we build it? What design and method should we use? What price should we set? It is tempting to think that physical infrastructure is no different. Many of the questions are the same. But there are differences, and the policy challenges around infrastructure stem from that. Firstly, infrastructure can be long-lived, which compounds the uncertainty about future usage rates and congestion. Secondly, the network element of the infrastructure makes it especially difficult to forecast market size. Thirdly, the social benefits that spill over to the broader economy are harder to quantify than a forecast revenue stream. All countries face the same challenges of providing enough infrastructure in the right places to serve the needs of their populations. So it is no surprise that infrastructure has been a recurring topic in the deliberations and work of the G20 group of major economies. Australia elevated the topic further during its presidency year in 2014. This year, the Argentine presidency has also included it as one of its key priorities and has reconvened the G20 Infrastructure Working Group, which met in Sydney earlier this month, just towards the beginning of this month. One typical challenge is risk management. Infrastructure risk takes many forms. There's the risk that the project is not built efficiently, that investors are unwilling, that demand is too high, leading to congestion, or not high enough. There are risks that revenue can't be collected as intended. There are risks that construction isn't resilient to natural disasters or just ordinary wear and tear. Another typical challenge is financing. Most infrastructure assets cost a lot up front to build, and their monetary return, if any, is only realised over a longer period. This can still be an attractive payoff structure for certain private investors, depending on how the project is structured. Ensuring private sector participation in infrastructure finance has therefore been a priority of the G20. A common thread in these challenges is that the nature of the risks and funding issues are very different in the build phase than in the run phase once infrastructure is being used. This is true of any large construction project, and similarly, one solution can be to have different actors involved in the two stages. The good news is that if we face common challenges, the solutions are also likely to be common. We can learn from each other. So there is value in sharing information about best practice across countries. For example, during Australia's G20 presidency in 2014, a global infrastructure hub was announced with the aim of, among other things, sharing guidance on best practices. If you think about it, the principles for designing a good road network or locating a railway line don't really change according to the country you live in. There will be differences relating to legal frameworks or other national specifics, but most of what constitutes best practice will be universal. To lessen the financing challenge, G20 authorities have been focusing on initiatives that can make infrastructure an attractive asset class. There is plenty of private sector financing looking for the stable long-term cash flows that certain kinds of infrastructure assets can provide once they are built. The question is how to bring that financing to the projects that need it, especially in emerging market economies where the need seems to be greatest. Different countries have approached this topic differently. The report, Roadmap to Infrastructure as an Asset Class, which G20 finance ministers and governors endorsed in March, proposed several initiatives that should help, including to enhance project preparation so that projects are more bankable, align the risk of projects to the risk profile of investors, increase the data available on projects, promote quality infrastructure and good governance, improve local currency capital markets in emerging markets, and explore the creation of standardised contracts for activities such as financing and risk sharing. Some of these initiatives can work as collaborative efforts with the private sector. Others, such as aligning risks, may require more effective use of credit enhancement from the public sector or from supranational agencies such as the multilateral development banks. This is seen as a way of crowding in private finance rather than have the multilateral development banks fund the project themselves. Here's where Australian experience might be instructive. As a central banker, I can look around the world and see that most countries have settled on the idea of having a specialist independent agency to carry out the kinds of responsibilities that central banks usually have, such as setting monetary policy or running the payment system. The same is true for many kinds of financial regulation. It is less common to have an autonomous agency involved in analysing and assessing microeconomic policy. But in Australia, we do have something like that in the Productivity Commission. And similarly, we have an independent statutory authority for assessing and prioritising infrastructure projects, Infrastructure Australia. As a non-specialist, it is not possible for me to quantify what difference this makes. But if common frameworks and rigorous preemptive analysis help, and I believe they do, then Australia's experience will surely be instructive for other economies wanting to improve their infrastructure. In comparison to some countries, international research suggests that Australia is fairly well served by its current infrastructure. But with a strongly growing population, we face a challenge of ensuring that the stock of infrastructure keeps pace with expanding needs. Utilities such as electricity and water, as well as transport links, need ongoing investment to accommodate a rising population. This challenge has clearly been recognised, and over recent years, governments at both the state and federal level have been increasing infrastructure investment. As you can see from this graph, public investment in communications infrastructure has increased with the rollout of the NBN. That's the light blue line at the bottom. Transport infrastructure, road and rail, has increased even more sharply and is back close to the share of GDP that it represented in the years immediately after the global financial crisis. The recent federal budget foreshadowed additional infrastructure spending. More broadly, investment by the federal government is projected to increase over coming years. Most of the infrastructure spend is by state governments, however. This has already increased notably, particularly in the southeastern states, and according to state budgets, it is projected to increase further in the next couple of years. Much of this work is in urban transport projects, both road and rail. Another area of infrastructure attracting substantial investment at the moment is renewable energy. The value of renewable generation projects slated for the next year or so is similar to the average of recent years' total investment in electricity generation, distribution and transmission, a much broader set of activities. Most of the investment in renewables is by the private sector. These projects have become more attractive lately as the cost of the underlying technology has fallen. At the same time, the cost of fossil-based inputs to existing generation methods has risen, and so has the price of electricity. So renewable energy projects are becoming increasingly commercially viable, as such as it is an area where the private sector can provide that infrastructure. And this is indeed what we're seeing. A range of data sources on both capital expenditure and financing show greatly increased activity recently. A few years ago, much of the investment in renewables was in small-scale rooftop solar. That's the red bars in this graph. More recently, as the economics of these projects has changed, we're seeing more large-scale solar and wind projects being financed and built. As I mentioned earlier, the risks and challenges of the build phase are very different from those in the run phase. There will be some areas, like renewables, where the private sector will be involved in both phases. In others, the execution and governance risks in the build phase don't match investors' desired risk profiles, but the revenue from the operation phase can do so. These kinds of projects will be good candidates for private ownership once construction is complete. Some state governments are recycling the revenue from those sales to fund new infrastructure. And finally, there are projects where the social benefits are not easily captured as cash flow. It is important that these kind of projects are not underprovided just because they would not be profitable for the private sector to run. Regardless of the exact approach to funding and management of construction, infrastructure investment can involve significant spillover benefits to the rest of the economy. The bank has discussed these recently and they bear repeating. The direct spillovers derive from the incomes earned by the workers and firms doing the work. Most of these projects are built by the private sector on behalf of the public sector. This income gets spent or invested, which in turn generates income for someone else and so on. At a time such as now, when there is still spare capacity in the economy, this fiscal multiplier can result in overall demand rising by considerably more than the overall spend on the project. More broadly, and over a longer horizon, the economy benefits from a larger capital stock and the productivity benefits of infrastructure of this type. These are often hard to quantify even after the fact, but some examples might include new export businesses enabled by the construction or expansion of an airport, higher productivity of logistic firms if their vehicles spend less time in traffic, and better health outcomes from reduced accident rates when roads are made safer. It is these benefits that are worth focusing on, more than the raw contribution of the building work to GDP growth. As I've emphasised on an earlier occasion, it isn't helpful to think of infrastructure as the new engine of growth, receiving the handover from the mining investment boom and later the apartment building boom. By its nature, infrastructure is justified by its contribution to the public good. It's not so much an engine of growth as an enabler of growth. But for this to be true, projects need to be rigorously assessed, carefully designed, and appropriately timed. And for that to be possible, it helps if practitioners can learn from each other, for example, through forums such as this one, and internationally, the initiatives of the G20. Thank you very much for your time. You've got a microphone now.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you all hear me now? Yeah, you can. Thank you very much for that address. I think it's interesting to reflect on the things that we do well in, and this is a common challenge across the world, and there's things that we do well in, things like financing of infrastructure, where we've been world leading, the creation of Infrastructure Australia, which I know from personal experience we were forever getting requests from people around the world to come and talk to us about what we were doing. But there's also things that we can learn from elsewhere as well. So it's a useful time to reflect. And the key one, the difference between funding and financing, which is often misunderstood. So
I was warned about that.
I just keep saying it. Just keep telling people, because we'd like them to... this is a room of people that know, but there's others that don't. So Lucy's kindly offered to take some questions from the room. So please pop your hands up. There's some microphones around to take your questions. Rob. There's a microphone just behind.
That was a great presentation. My question was around, you mentioned certainly the benefits, the productivity benefits of infrastructure. In Australia, between states, there's a real difference in how much work is going on at the moment off the back of, you know, certain policy decisions around asset recycling and others. Do you have any concerns around, say, the economic impacts of having perhaps a two-speed economy in New South Wales and Victoria, and then a slower investment in infrastructure in other parts of the country?
Thanks. It's a really good question. And I think the way I'd frame it is they're the two states where the strength in population growth is at the moment. One of, you know, the underlying issue for Australia, I mean, I was referencing the McKinsey study earlier that said, you know, our infrastructure gap is not that great compared to even quite a number of advanced economies, let alone a number of emerging market economies. But what we do need to do is consider that we actually have one of the fastest growing populations of all advanced economies, and we therefore need to accommodate that growth, the extent, you know, as that continues, and we have to accommodate that in the places where the people are moving. And at the moment, that is increasingly Sydney and Melbourne, whereas, you know, Perth population growth has slowed. Well, Western Australia, generically, population growth has slowed quite drastically relative to the mining investment boom era. These are big shifts in population. And so, in some sense, this is really meeting the demand. And so it's not so surprising to me that it's the southeastern states that are finding themselves wanting to do this, because they're the ones that are having to meet the needs of growing, you know, really rapidly growing populations. Thanks for the question. At the back.
Hi, Lucy. Jenny Wiggins from the Financial Review. You showed us a nice chart of transport infrastructure projects, which I'm sure everyone here is familiar with. There are a lot happening at the moment, earlier on in your speech. But we also know that a lot of companies are struggling to find enough skilled people to actually build the transport infrastructure that we need. And to what extent do you think the lack of skilled labour currently in Australia is hampering companies' ability to invest?
Thanks. It's a very, very good question. We are hearing stories about difficulties attracting suitable labour in very specific areas, and certainly ensuring that you sequence your infrastructure projects and don't all clump them together at once is important. You don't all want to be rushing in trying to do the same thing at once. It is worth noting that a lot of the skills are the same skills that are involved in large-scale building construction, so apartments. So to the extent that there's some handoff of, you know, that the apartment sector is no longer growing across the nation, that frees up some. But what we're hearing from our contacts is it's still relatively specific skills. And I think one of the things is about lags is we've gone through a long period where maybe those skills were not being developed. You know, they're not things that you learn at school. It's like how to be a project manager. You don't there are qualifications in that, but it's not something you learn at school or even in sort of most university or TAFE courses. It's something you build up over time. And so then you come down 15 down, years down the line, and there isn't a project manager with 15 years experience. Well, maybe you might have to take someone with 5 years experience. The other thing we're not seeing is wide scale increases in wages growth for this. So, you know, we're at the stage where there are concerns about shortages of certain types of skilled labour, but it is quite contained to certain occupational groups. And at the moment, what we're not seeing is employers trying to solve that problem by paying people more. And, you know, you can always poach someone from someone else, and they're not doing that. We're not seeing that in the numbers.
So you're suggesting that because we're not seeing that jump in wages like we saw during the mining boom, that potentially then it's not as severe, the lack of skills, as we saw in the mining boom?
Well, I mean, it depends on whether you frame it as a lack of skill or a strength in demand. I mean, I think certainly during the mining investment boom, it was, you know, more common to sort of just go overseas and get those skills. That's, you know, the rules have changed. That's a little bit more onerous now. It is still possible, but it is not as easy as it had been. And I think it is simply, well, if you can't find somebody at the current wage, well, maybe offer something higher and see if someone who's got a job somewhere else jumps, because that's how this happens. And then sooner or later, someone else will say, well, this person doesn't have any experience, but I'm going to take them on because they seem smart and I'm going to train them up. And that's how the process works, and it just takes a while for that realisation to dawn.
Further questions?
Over here.
Adrian Hart.
Thanks for that great speech, Lucy. Adrian Hart, BIS Oxford Economics. What we're seeing at the moment seems to be another boom. We had the boom in mining. Now we're having this boom in infrastructure, in particular areas like Sydney and Melbourne, but potentially elsewhere as well. What strikes me, what you said in your speech about the timeliness is also important, that we seem to go through these cycles and we seem to have these big swings, ups and downs in the project pipeline. And the earlier speech today from Infrastructure Australia talked at ways of reforming that we can introduce to try and create a more sustainable funding, I suppose, for infrastructure over time. How do you feel about some of the reforms that were suggested and ways, because it seems that we go through state governments having very large cycles in their own revenues and they spend it on infrastructure when they can, when what we want to achieve really is a consistent increasing level of infrastructure to match our demand over time. And how will those reforms from Infrastructure Australia help that regard?
Thanks for the question. I am not a microeconomic expert. I'm a macroeconomist, so I don't feel like I can really talk with any expertise about the costings or the effects or the modelled benefits of the reforms that were discussed in Julianne's speech. I don't think that's something I can provide any expertise on. But just let me give you one reflection. There is this belief that, oh, well, there was this boom and then there was this other boom and then there was this other boom. It all seemed very convenient. But one of the things economics teaches us is that people respond to price incentives. Of course, the mining industry was putting in a lot of construction when the price incentives in bulk commodities were telling them that this was an incredibly profitable thing to do. And that was bidding up the price of the inputs to that. And so everybody else quite wisely said, well, I'm not going to do that while it's expensive. And so as the mining investment boom turns down, the price of those inputs starts to come off, it then, and yet we still have very strong population growth, so it's very profitable to build some apartments. Well, then people then say, well, here we go, here's some it's very profitable for us to build apartments. And similarly, as now that that's come off, although we still do have very strong population growth, we do seem to have finally started to catch up to that in terms of the housing construction. There's a clear incentive, and it's a little bit different in the infrastructure space because, of course, it's not an obvious price incentive. But wouldn't you choose to build your infrastructure at a time when the mining industry isn't wanting to build lots of infrastructure? So, I mean, the beauty of economies is you don't actually have to talk to the other people to know what they're doing. You just have to look at the prices, and that can be a large part of how you make your decisions. One aspect that you did mention is sort of the cyclicality in state government revenue, and you're referring specifically to stamp duty, which is very cyclical, as indeed is capital gains tax revenue and anything that, that leverages off an asset price and an asset turnover cycle. That's true, and that's why you have debt financing as well, in order to smooth through those cycles.
Julianne Metzi.
Hi, Lucy. It's Julianne Metzi from AMP Capital. I want to ask you a very RBA question. There are some parts of the investor community who think that there is an infrastructure asset bubble and prices have been a bit frothy. And that really depends upon your view of whether or not interest rates are going to continue lower for longer. So if you can comment on whether or not you think there's an asset bubble and are we in a lower for longer phase?
That was a really nice way of asking me what's going to happen to interest rates. And I'm going to find a really nice way of not answering, because I can't improve on what the governor said 2 days ago. We are in a world where interest rates have been low for some time. And around the world, low bond rates in particular, and low yields, low term spreads in particular, have then fed into higher asset valuations. And if those interest rates stay where they are, then those asset valuations make perfect sense. When people talk about bubbles, they normally talk about people buying things sort of purely with the expectation of capital gain. But what you're talking about is saying, at a particular discount rate, this all makes sense, and it's the discount rate we currently have. The question is, will the discount rate rise? That's not the same thing as a bubble. That doesn't mean it won't be painful if there is a rapid repricing of assets, but it's not specifically speaking a bubble. What you're talking about is whether the fundamentals that are currently in play will be in play for a long period of time. And, that's really talking about long rates, not the policy rate. And, one of the things that has been holding long rates low across the world has been low term spreads, as well as expectations of low monetary policy rates. Of course, we've seen, including this week, that, around the world, there are actually countries that are saying, well, we're now in a space where, unemployment is very low, inflation's starting to pick up. It's time to get interest rates off the troughs where they had been in those countries. Australia is in a different situation, firstly because our interest rates never got so low here, but also we're still in a world where there is spare capacity. So I think it really comes down to what you think about the global interest rate structure more so than what's happening to the specific policy decisions here.
Hi, Lucy. Quick question. You spoke to the need for private funding. What are your views on the ATO integrity measures?
Sorry?
The ATO integrity measures, stapling, removing gearing. Do you think that's creating some sovereign risk and a bit of a gap? And is there enough local appetite to fill that gap, do you think?
I'm not qualified to speak specifically about sort of the tax measures that you're referring to. I think, as always, Australia, is an attractive investment destination because of, the quality of its institutions, because of the comparative advantages that it has, because of the skill base of its people, because we have resources that other people don't have, oftentimes. And, one particular regulatory mechanism may or may not make that difference. My observation from my own dealings in the G20 and so forth is there's a huge sector of particularly life insurance and pension funds, both here and around the world, that really like the idea of a steady income flow for very long over very long-lived assets. And these are institutions that are trying to fund very long-lived liabilities. And even the the bond markets that we're talking about, although there has been issuance at the very long end of the curve by some countries, it's not universal. There's not that much out there for them to buy. If you want, if you've got a liability horizon that's 20, 30, 40 years, the bond market won't help you that much. You need something longer, and that's exactly where an infrastructure asset seems to have the right kind of lifetime to be compatible. So, is it a knife edge that will make everybody suddenly run away? I suspect not.
Alan.
Lucy, the elephant in the room for all governments in Australia is, of course, how to fund the infrastructure. And when Queensland was downgraded, its credit rating from AAA to AA+, I understand that its borrowing costs increased by about 50 basis points. And whilst the Commonwealth still maintains a AAA credit rating, this year's budget confirms how it's understandably favouring concessional loans or equity injections rather than traditional grant funding just to lower the burden on its own balance sheet. When the Reserve Bank is looking at interest rates generally, is the size of the Commonwealth's debt burden something you take into account, or do you leave that to the Department of Treasury to wrestle with rating agencies?
I'm not in the business of opining about fiscal policy, but it is a very good question, and I think the way I would frame it is actually to look at the actual debt-to-GDP ratios of Australia versus some other countries. In my prior role, I was the head of financial stability, and you know, one of the things that we grappled with in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis was how to implement the Basel III rules here in Australia when sort of the amount of government debt that was out there wasn't really was much, much lower than in other countries, and therefore that affected how much liquid assets the banks had to hold. I think if you compare, you know, it's very instructive to compare sort of debt levels relative to other countries. I mean, certainly there are countries out there with very large government debt levels which are becoming a problem for them, but Australia is just not in that category. It has a much lower level of debt than many other countries.
I'm afraid that probably concludes the time we have for questions. Thank you very much for your candour and insights today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Lucy Ellis.